That year was 6 BC. Herod the Great, the king of the Jews, was on the throne. He was great by many measures, one of the primary characters of ancient history. He had a lengthy rule, but in many ways fulfilled the description of a despot in all the things that he did. His biography is a lengthy list of misdeeds and intrigue in order to gain and to keep power. He married 10 different wives. He fathered a lengthy list of children. He struggled with indecision about who ought to succeed him and whether his kingdom ought be subdivided. And so he wrote 6 different wills defining which of his sons should be his successor. Throughout his lengthy reign, he dealt with some of the most famous characters of history, Julius Caesar and Octavius and Brutus and Cassius and Antony and Cleopatra, with whom he had a special rivalry because their 2 kingdoms bordered one another. Although he was called the king of the Jews, Herod was in fact himself not really a Jew. He was an Idumean by birth, a half-Jew at best. And so his claim to the throne was not one of heredity, but rather one of politics. Through cold-blooded murder, through some strange twists in the course of history, through the endorsement of the Roman Senate and the appointment of the Roman Caesar, he was a king, and he did in fact rule as a puppet monarch over Palestine. But in order to keep that power, he had to constantly engage in wars and in intrigue. For example, in the rivalry that went on between Octavius and Antony, he would sometimes side with Antony and sometimes side with Octavius in the hope that he would end up on the right side, which he did not always. And then he would, with an amazing astuteness for politics, convince the winner that he really was on his side all along and somehow be able to survive the military and political turmoil. When his competitors became his wives, he had them put in shackles for years at a time. When the Hasmoneans, who were the previous holders of the throne in Palestine, became competitive, he had them executed. When one was left over who was still holding some political position, he had him drowned while his friends roughhoused with him near Jericho in a swimming party that ended up supposedly in an accidental death. His own sons he had murdered and executed because he thought that they were coming to too much political power around him. And yet, in spite of all that he did, there were those, particularly at his time, that thought that compared to the other ancient monarchs, he was really pretty good. He was mostly a good guy in that he made some significant positive contributions. He kept Rome off of many Hebrew backs during those decades prior to the birth of Jesus. He enabled Palestine to maintain a certain level of autonomy. He continued many of the Hebrew Jewish traditions. He rebuilt the temple, or at least initiated the rebuilding of the temple, that which in its original splendor had been built by Solomon, but then destroyed and rebuilt by Zerubbabel, was rebuilt in great splendor at enormous cost under the rule of King Herod the Great. His capital city was the city of Jerusalem, not a large city by any means in today's standards of Mexico City or of Tokyo or of New York City, but it was large for an ancient city, not as large, of course, as Rome, but significant in the place that it held. It was cosmopolitan and sophisticated because it was on the trade route, the crossroads, really, of that part of the Roman Empire. There were people there in the marketplace on just about any day of the week who had come from as far to the west as Spain, as far to the east as Persia, or even perhaps as far as India or China. You could hear people speaking in Latin or in Greek or in Hebrew or perhaps in Egyptian or one of the other African tongues. There were people who had all different types of garments and who represented all different types of monarchies. Jerusalem was, in a sense, a combination of the very best and the very worst. The very best in that there were godly people, men and women who were devoted to Yahweh, the king of the heavens and the earth. Those who read the Old Testament diligently and sought to live by its principles and its laws, who faithfully sacrificed in the temple as had been prescribed under Moses, those who prayed daily waiting for the Messiah to come and genuinely believed that the Old Testament prophecies were true. But also in that city, there was corruption, there was political intrigue, there was prostitution, there was idolatry, and there was the military occupation of the Romans that considered that part of the empire, even though under the puppet monarch Herod. Herod had a long reign. He was near the end of it, almost 70 years old, failing health. And so he decided that he would move south, at least temporarily, to the city of Jericho, because there were those warm therapeutic baths, and he thought that maybe if he were to soak in those baths that eventually he could regain some measure of health and strength. There were those who understood what he was doing as weakness, and they saw it as an opportunity to rebel against some of the iron rule that he had given. There were, for example, two Jewish rabbis, one named Matthias, the other named Judas, who thought it an absolute sacrilege that Herod had had an eagle put on the gates of the temple. And so in defiance, they actually climbed up to the gates and ripped the eagle off. And Herod, showing that he was as tough as ever, had them caught and burned alive. He was concerned that when he died, the people might celebrate because his rule had come to an end. And so he put out an invitation all over Palestine that the elite of the country come to the city of Jericho. And so he had the most famous and powerful of politicians, of theologians, of business persons, of the intelligentsia, the teachers, the religious leaders. And they all came and were invited into the hippodrome that he had had built in the city of Jericho. Once in there, he had them put under guard and an order of execution that on the day he died, they were all to be killed. That way he would guarantee there be no celebration in Palestine in his death, but that there would be universal mourning across the country because their leadership had all died. And the story goes on and on and on. He was jealous of his son, Antipater, and not able to find a way to guarantee that competition would not come from his own offspring, he sent an embassy and petitioned Rome and asked for permission to have his own son executed so that he wouldn't compete with him any longer. And Caesar gave that permission, and Antipater was executed. He was frightened that he would lose his power. He was frightened that he would die. There was economic difficulty. There were threats of insurrection. And in the middle of all this, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. He was disturbed because it was one more problem, one more competitor in all of these that were trying to take away his throne. And this one, allegedly a legitimate competitor, for all of the others were merely political rivals. But if it be true that this one is a full-blooded Jew and in the line of David, who knows what might happen? There might actually be followers who would try to overthrow Herod, maybe even try to overthrow Rome and put this newborn king on the throne. He was disturbed. And those who knew about it in Jerusalem were disturbed as well, because there were many who were dependent upon Herod for their power and for their perks, and they didn't want to lose out to some new king. And even those who hated Herod were worried lest it divide the country, worried lest there be an instability to the government, worried lest this new king might be as bad or worse even than Herod. The Magi who came to the big city knew nothing of all this. They were from a place far away where the newspapers did not carry the local politics of Palestine. They probably didn't even know Herod's name. They had no idea the political problems that he had. They were simply magicians, occultists, followers of horoscopes. They were astrologers. Unlike much of our art and some of our music, They really weren't kings in the sense of being the head of government. Magi in those days were many. They were a priestly caste in Babylon and Persia. There were thousands of them. They spent their time gazing at the stars and trying to predict national and individual prophecies of the future. They weren't very successful. They were unusual people, only that when they saw this star that did not quite fit their charts, they decided to check it out. They decided to check it out in total ignorance of the Old Testament, of its prophecies, of Yahweh God, of all of the things that we may take for granted. They decided to follow it, and somewhere en route, they picked up a new notion. Maybe on a caravan, they met a Jew who knew some of the Old Testament prophecies. For whatever the reason, they concluded that the star they were following was leading them to the birthplace of a new king for the Jews. When they arrived in Jerusalem, into the big city, they started checking around and decided that the place to go was to the palace itself. And there, talking to a guard or to a secretary or to someone else in probably the lower echelons of the palace hierarchy, they asked if anyone knew the place where the king had been born. Being a loyal follower, whoever got that message passed it along to a superior who passed it along to another superior who eventually whispered in the ear of King Herod. Herod by then was quite paranoid about all of these threats against his throne. And so he insisted that these magi, who otherwise would have been lost in the crowds of the big city of Jerusalem, be brought into his presence. He talked to them, and he asked them what they had heard, and they asked him where the king was to be born. Herod wanted to know as well, because he wanted to kill this baby king just as he had killed all of the other competition. And he did what ancient people do and what we in our era especially do. He called on the experts. He brought in the theologians, the Bible scholars, the chief priests, and asked them where the baby to be born king of the Jews was to be born. He really didn't need to do that. He probably could have gone out to almost any religious Jew out in the marketplace or in the countryside and asked the question and gotten a quick answer. Because they all knew about Micah. Micah was a prophet that had lived 700 years before, a prophet in the tiny little town of Moresheth. Micah was a small town guy. He was a very minor prophet in comparison to, say, Isaiah in ancient Israel. Micah didn't live in the big city. Micah wasn't well connected. Micah didn't have the sophistication that Isaiah had. Isaiah traveled to the capitals. Isaiah knew the heads of state. Isaiah spoke powerfully and prophetically to nations. Micah lived in the little town and preached there and wrote his words down. But they were from God. They were words, painful words of doom. He told his own people that when you sin against God, while the punishment and consequences might not instantly come, they will eventually come. And that the personal and collective sins of Israel would be judged by God himself. It was a sure thing. And so his prophecy was bleak and painful. But in the midst of this bleak and painful prophecy, he wrote some words of hope, saying, "You, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." Oh, they all knew that. And so it was no difficulty at all for the experts to tell Herod and the Magi. They didn't quote Micah quite precisely. For example, they updated their terminology. No one in those days even ever referred to Bethlehem as being an Ephrathah. That was the name of the man who was the founder of that little village, that tiny town. But by then, Bethlehem was known far more in terms of the province in which it was located, and that was Judea. And so they said it would be in Bethlehem in Judea. The rest they paraphrase, saying that a Messiah would be born, saying that he would be a shepherd over the people of Israel, a good shepherd, a loving and kind shepherd, a shepherd unlike Herod, who had fleeced the sheep. He would be a shepherd who would love the sheep and who would care for them. Bethlehem. That was a stunning idea for Herod. Bethlehem? I mean, of all places, that was almost the most unlikely place. Oh, it's true that King David had been born in Bethlehem, but that was 1,000 years earlier. Bethlehem had decreased in importance and deteriorated in population in that 1,000 years. It was out of the way. It was unimportant. When the trade caravans would go back and forth between Herod's Jerusalem and Cleopatra's Egypt, they would go through the city of Hebron. That was the main route. It was off that route that you'd find Bethlehem, located on a craggy outgrowth of the Judean mountains on the eastern edge of the wilderness, the desert. It was a place of little significance. It was a place of little population. It was a place of almost no economic importance. It was a tiny, unimportant town. In fact, so insignificant that every time anyone mentioned it, which was hardly ever, there always had to be an explanation given, because there were two Bethlehems, Bethlehem in Zebulun and Bethlehem in Judea, and every single time it was mentioned, there had to be some telling of which one it was. But it was Bethlehem. In this out-of-the-way place, this has-been town, this non-city, the most significant event in all of history had taken place. The king was born. No ordinary king. For ordinary kings, if kings be ordinary, have their life begin 9 months before their birth, but not this king. This king, Micah had long ago said, had origins that are from old, from ancient times. Herod didn't understand that. Surely the Magi didn't. I'm not even sure that the Bible scholars and chief priests understood it. For that child born was ancient even in Micah's day, 700 years earlier, because he was God. God who is as ancient as eternity and older still even than that. That which had been supernaturally predicted 7 centuries before had actually happened. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report it to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way. And the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it was stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child and his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. There was another special message, a message that came to Mary and Joseph to take that child quickly out of town, to quickly escape to Egypt, because Herod had done something typical of his character and absolutely despicable in the absolute. He had ordered that all male children born within a 2-year period in and around Bethlehem be immediately executed to make sure that any threat to this old man's throne be taken care of. And so while Christmas may to us conjure up words of joy, of happiness, and of birth, for many mothers and fathers, many families, who from that time and for the rest of their lives thought of Christmas not as birth, but as death, not as joy, but as grief. For their hopes were also tied to their baby boys, and their hopes had been killed with a sword. I find some powerful principles in this ancient story. I find here the principle that God rules history. And I am astounded to discover that he rules it in the smallest of detail. Not only who, but when and where. that hundreds of years in advance he has it figured out to the finest of details. That he knows when his Christ will be born and where and to whom, and he lays it out in precision and makes sure that all of the pieces fit precisely together as they should. And gives to us an annual Christmas reminder that he still is the God who rules history. He still is the God not only of the sweeping changes of the world from China to Czechoslovakia, but also of the finest details and even the most out-of-the-way places. That he is the God who manages the affairs of history down to us and to our lives. And precisely when we think that the world in general and our own biographies in particular are spinning hopelessly out of control, is precisely when we need to remember that God rules history as much today as he did back then. God rules history, and God draws unlikely persons to himself. And I count the Magi to be among the most unlikely of all. When you read those sometimes dreary laws of the Old Testament, you find what God thinks of sorcery, of the occult, of astrology, and horoscopes, and magic. You find that it was strictly forbidden. You find that in certain instances it was a capital offense and required execution. You find that God, in the community of the Hebrew people, would have nothing to do with anyone that participated in those practices. And yet that's what the Magi did for a living. They were not readers of scripture. They were not religious people. They were superstitious to the core. They gave their lives to gazing at the stars and trying to understand history and everything, not by God in revelation, but by the movement of the celestial bodies. They were not Jews, the chosen people. They were Gentiles. They were as heathen could be, not pursuing after God, but pursuing after some heavenly light that they thought was most unusual from anything they had ever seen before. And yet those are precisely the ones whom God drew to his Son. And therein I find great hope. I discover that God draws to himself and to his Son those who are not squeaky clean, those who do not have everything all figured out and everything in place, those who are not always the insiders, but the outsiders, the most unlikely of all, are those modern magi whom he still seeks. He is the God who rules history. He is the God who draws unlikely persons to himself. And he is the God who acts in out-of-the-way places. For while it may seem that history is made in places with names like Rome or London or Washington or Moscow or Jerusalem, the truth is that he is the God of the places that we have never heard of before, the places with the hard-to-pronounce names, the streets that are hard to spell, and those of us who live there, those of us whose names will never be recorded in the important places in history, those of us who are in the out-of-the-way places like Bethlehem in Zebulun or Bethlehem in Judea. And it is there that he, as described by the poet as the hound of heaven, pursues us and finds us in order to bring us to himself. So much for prophecy. A moment for the personal. With whom would you identify in the old Christmas story? Would you say this Christmas you are more like Herod, who sought to eliminate the Christmas Christ from his life? Or would you say you are more like the Magi, willing to leave home and everything else in order to go as far as necessary to find him and to worship him? For you see, after almost 2,000 years, the same choice is being made all over again. I end the telling of the Christmas story with the telling of another story. It, too, is a story about the big city and about a tiny town Not an ancient story, but a modern story. And a true story. A story that begins on the outskirts of a tiny town in rural Brazil. In a one-room house with a dirt floor where poor people live. The furnishings are as simple as can be. A wood-burning stove in the middle of the room. Two wooden pallets that serve as beds on opposite sides. Walls with two decorations, an out-of-date calendar and a crucifix. In that house for many years has lived a woman named Maria. She was widowed shortly after her daughter, Christina, was born. She had offers of remarriage, but declined them all, determined that she would raise her daughter alone. And with a fierce and difficult independence, went to work and tried to make ends meet. Her life was harsh, hard. But by the time Christina was 15, things had leveled out some. While they were still very poor, at least Maria, in her job as a maid, had a consistent income, and so there was a predictability about there being food for them to eat. And also, it was getting to be about the time that Christina was herself old enough to go to work, and so there would be an additional contribution to the income of the family. Christina, beautiful. Long black hair, olive skin, perfect complexion, dancing, darting eyes, contagious laughter, attractive personality, so that the offers of marriage to her were many. But she made a decision that she would be unlike the other teenagers in her little tiny town. And she would not marry young, as just about everyone did. She was determined, with some of that independence of her mother, to make it on her own. In fact, her dream was that someday she would go to the big city of Rio de Janeiro, and there she would have all the excitement of all that that city held. Her mother hated it when she talked like that. She knew too much about the city. Her daughter knew so little. She wondered how her daughter would fare with sinful and sophisticated people. She wondered where her daughter would live, what her daughter would do, although she feared what her daughter would do, because she had heard the stories about pretty young girls from tiny towns who went to the big city and who, desperation, did what they had to do in order to make enough money to live. Maria's worst nightmares came true when she woke up one morning and looked across the one room that was their house and saw that the pallet that was used for a bed was empty. And she knew where Christina had gone. And so she took all of her savings, all the money that she could put together. And she went and she bought a bus ticket to Rio. And with some of the little money that she had left over while she waited for the bus, she went into a drugstore where there was one of those machines where you put in coins, and you have your picture taken, where you get four different poses, one after the other. And she put in every coin she could until she had a whole pile of pictures of herself. It was then that the bus came, and with her tickets, only a very little money left, and with this pile of pictures, she went to Rio. When she got there, she asked directions to find the places where the streetwalkers live and where the prostitutes practice their trade. And then, one by one, as best she could, she went to every bar, every hotel, every restaurant. And she would either go up to the mirror in the lobby or go into the ladies' room. And she would write a note on the back of the picture of herself, and either put it in the little anchor that would hold the mirror, or on the edge of the wooden frame, or tape it to the glass. Or if she was out on the street and saw a telephone booth there attached to the wall or to the phone itself, she would leave a picture until eventually the pictures were all gone and her money was all gone. And so she got back in the bus and went back to her tiny rural town and waited. It was some weeks later that one morning Maria, or rather Christina, was coming down the stairs of a dilapidated hotel. Her appearance had changed. Her hair was disheveled. The sparkle was out of her eyes. There was no laughter. She seemed years older than her teenage age. As she walked across the lobby, she was startled to have her attention drawn to a familiar face on a picture in the lobby mirror. She walked over to it, and there, with her throat closing, choked, and tears filling her eyes, she took the picture of her mother and looked at it and turned it over and read the message that her mother had written to her. Whatever you have done, whatever you have become, it doesn't matter. Please come home. She did. Christina came home. Will you? Will you come home this Christmas to Jesus?